We're going to be doing a four-part series about the afterlife, about life after death in the rabbinic tradition. And I will try to show that it's not just science fiction kind of interest, just the occult or the unusual, but that they're very significant ideas that relate to a whole host of important religious philosophical topics. And we're going to go on to discuss, is this a good motivation for religious life? Should one be thinking about the world to come? But before we even get to the nature of the world to come, and should one be thinking about it, we're going to discuss the concept of reincarnation, the concept of Yogur. Yogur Nefashot, clearly this is something that exists in other traditions as well. There's Hindu and Greek discussion of Yogur, but we of course are going to discuss it from a Jewish perspective. What is the Jewish approach to Yogur Neshamot? And I'd like to start with two introductory points. The first introductory point I'd like to make is based on a tshuva of the Ralbach, Rabbi Levi Ibn Chaim. Rabbi Levi Ibn Chaim has a tshuva, and in that tshuva, he was asked, actually, it's tshuva chet of the Ralbach, he was asked, is it obligatory to believe in reincarnation, to believe in Gilgul Neshamot? And he talks about two different groups. He says there's a kat chokrim, kafi sichlam, there's a group that investigates based on intellect, and clearly he's talking about the philosophers, and he mentions that they also study secular knowledge. And he says that they tend to reject Gilgul Neshamot, that Judaism does not have a concept of reincarnation. Then he mentions that there's a kat acheret, there's another group who are clearly the Kabbalists who do believe in it. So Rabbi Levi Ibn Chaim sets up the dilemma as the Jewish philosophers of the Middle Ages versus the Jewish Kabbalists. And there's a lot of truth to that. Certainly we will see that most of the great Rishonim who were part of the medieval rationalist tradition rejected the concept of reincarnation. And the Kabbalists pretty much universally accepted the concept of Gilgul. It's an important concept in such Kabbalistic texts as the Bahir and the Zohar. And when one moves to the Ari's Kabbalah, it becomes even more pronounced in works of Rav Chaim Vital. Rav Chaim Vital actually has a work called Shar HaGilgulim. So there's a lot of truth to Rav Levi Ibn Chabib's presentation. At the same time, I wouldn't only assume that this is always the case, meaning there might be rationalists who might accept Gilgul. We should not too easily assume that Gilgul Neshamot is a irrational or only a mystical perspective. This is true both in the non-Jewish world and in the Jewish world. For example, in the non-Jewish world, such philosophers as Plato and Pythagoras believed in the concept of Gilgul. And we have the greatest philosophers believing in it. In the Jewish world, one might point to the Barbanel. Now, the Barbanel was not a radical rationalist. At the same time, I'm not sure we would refer to him as a mystic as well. The Barbanel in Sefer Dvarim, we'll discuss later with the context, affirms his belief in Gilgul Neshamot. So the first point is that there is a debate here, or perhaps a general split between rationalists and mystics and Kabbalists, but it should not be stated too strongly. The second piece of introductory information is that the concept of Gilgul might depend on how one thinks about the human soul. And in Greek philosophy, which in turn was manifest in the medieval Jewish tradition as well, there were two major approaches to thinking about the soul. Plato taught a mind and body dualism, or a soul and body dualism. In this view, the soul and body are really separate. And the soul uses the body in the same way we would talk of our body using an axe. And this is very manifest in several of his works, I think particularly so in the story of Socrates' death. When Socrates' students seem upset that he will die, he says, what's the big deal? The soul, which is the real me, has been shackled with the limitations of the human body, and now it will escape those limitations. This is one way of thinking about the soul as something that might have existed before the body, could be inserted into the body, and removed. Clearly, according to this view, the concept of Gilgul is really possible. Right? The soul is something that exists independent of the body, and outlasts the body, and could then perhaps be inserted into a different body. However, there's another view of the soul, which is the Aristotelian view. And here, Aristotle refers to the soul as the form of the body. Now, form is not something that can exist without matter. Form is what makes the thing what it is. For example, sight is the form of the eye. Right? What makes an eye, that it can exist And the Rambam uses this terminology when talking about the soul. He also talks about the soul as the tzura of the nefesh. Now, it should be clear that from the Aristotelian perspective, it's difficult to think of the soul either being there before the body, or outliving the body, or being put into another body. So they very well may be that the first and fundamental question might be, what concept of the soul are we working with? And indeed, this was quite clear to the Rishonim. The Rambam himself never mentions Gilgul Neshamot. It may be because his conception of the soul rendered that impossible. Now, there is another issue we might come back to later in this series, which is that the Rambam's position might raise questions regarding Tchiyat HaMeitim and Olam Haba. What exactly lives on? How does the person achieve eternal bliss or immortality, which is a point we'll return to. But certainly it would seem that if one accepts the Aristotelian conception of the soul, it will be quite difficult to believe in Gilgul. And indeed, the Barbanel in Dvarim, in Parshat Ki Peiteh, quotes various Aristotelian objections to Gilgul and says that we can affirm them because we don't accept that conception of the soul. We have a conception of the soul as an independent entity that could then go into another body. This is even clear in those that are opposed to Gilgul Neshamot. In the Sefer Ikarim of Rav Yosef Albo, in Mamar Dalet Perek Chof Tet, he first discusses what the Jewish conception of the soul is, and he says that the Jewish conception of the soul is like Plato. It is something Nivdal. It is a separate entity. So in theory, he could believe in Gilgul, yet he rejects Gilgul on other grounds. But it's clear to him that the opening question must be, do we start with a Platonic conception of the soul or an Aristotelian? With these two pieces of background, we can now turn to Gilgul Neshamot throughout Jewish history. And there is no clear mention of this concept in Tanakh or in the Gemara. There are some concepts that might seem similar but are not the same. For example, one might think of Pinchas Hu Eliyahu, right, the Midrashic rabbinic identification of Pinchas with Elio. However, that identification need not be understood in terms of Gilgul. The identification might argue that Pinchas truly is Elio. And Dr. Harris Goldstein once pointed out to me that there's some Gemarot that assume that Elio was a Kohen. So if you assume he's a Kohen, you're not assuming Gilgul. Because when you have a case of Gilgul, the offspring doesn't share the ritual status of the first manifestation of that person. Right, if the Kohen then comes back as a Yisrael, they're Yisrael. So any Gemara that assumes that Elio is a Kohen is identifying him in a more direct way with Pinchas. And the absence of this doctrine is going to be used by the philosophers, or the absence of explicit mention of Gilgul and Chazal, will be used by the philosophers as an argument against Gilgul Neshamot. Of course, the Kabbalists might argue that this is an esoteric doctrine. Right? Many Kabbalistic doctrines, they would argue, were not taught in an open way, but only as a hidden doctrine that gets revealed later. And this is a point we'll come back to. Let's now deal with the arguments for and the arguments against. And I think that there are three essential arguments in favor of Gilgul Neshamot. The classic argument in favor is Gilgul Neshamot would be a solution to the famous problem of Tzadik V'ra Lo, the problem of theodicy. The perennial religious conundrum, the most difficult question, how a benevolent and omnipotent God could allow suffering. This is something that has troubled religious thinkers through the ages, and indeed there are several, really many approaches to this problem. Gilgul Neshamot might be one answer. If we see someone suffering, and nothing in their current life justifies that suffering, it may very well be that things that happened in a previous lifetime are the explanation. And here, there's a huge advantage to this approach over other theodicies. There are many theodicies that can't explain the suffering of small children. For example, let us assume that suffering is for sin, but a five-year-old is someone who hasn't really sinned yet. Let us assume that suffering promotes personal growth. Again, it might be harder to argue that for a very small child. But adherents of the belief in Gilgul Neshamot argue that this was a better theodicy. This could explain even the suffering of an innocent child. And as we look through the classic sources, many of them talk about Gilgul Neshamot in the context of Tzadik V'ra Lo. For example, the Sefer Bahir, the classic mystical text, talks about it as a solution to Tzadik V'ra Lo. Rabbi Levi Ibn Chabib, I mentioned before, in his tshuva, He talks about this as an answer to Tzadik Ra'ala. The Ramban, in his Perush on Iyov, again, mentions, or I shouldn't say mentions, he alludes, he hints at this doctrine in the context of Tzadik Ra'ala. And there the Ramban does something quite interesting. The Sefer Iyov, of course, is the classic work in our canon in Tanakh about the problem of theodicy. And the three friends dialogue with Iyov about why Iyov is suffering. Then at the end, a fellow named Elihu comes by and says his approach. The Ramban argues that Elihu is the one with the correct approach. And he has a number of sources to argue this. He points out that Hashem at the end faults the three friends for not speaking the correct way to Iyov. He does not fault Elihu. Also, Iyov responds to the friends, but he does not respond to Elihu. This and some other arguments motivates Ramban to assume that Elihu has the correct answer. Now, the Ramban apparently did not think Gilgul Neshamot should be an openly taught doctrine. So the Ramban only hints at it. In fact, the Ramban hints at this in several places. He has a work, a philosophic work called Shar HaGmul, and he has a Perush on Iyov. Both appear in the Kol Kitvei HaRamban put out by Rabbi Shavel. In both places, he just hints at some doctrine that is the correct interpretation of Elihu. But Rabbeinu Bachaya, his student, who has a commentary on Chumash, he elucidates the doctrine of the Ramban. He says, we're talking about Gilgul Neshamot. Indeed, Elihu has a pasuk where he says, Rutapash bisaro kanar. His flesh becomes soft like a child. Yashuv lime alumav. It returns to the days of its youth. Which he takes to mean not that the person suddenly feels younger, but the person literally comes back in a younger guise through Gilgul Neshamot. This is in Iyo Paraglam and Gimel pasuk kapeh. That's where the pasuk is. And that is the answer of Elihu, which according to Ramban, is the correct answer to the problem of Tzadik Ra'ala. So this is one argument, and I think perhaps the strongest argument through the centuries for those who wanted to believe in Gilgul Neshamot. Just to mention others who think along the same lines, so Rav Shlomo Alkabetz has a parish on Rut called Shoresh Yishai. In that parish, he also advocates on behalf of Gilgul Neshamot. And he has a very interesting reading of a Gemara Brachot. There's a classic Gemara Brachot on Dav Zayin that tries to figure out why the righteous suffer. Among the answers given there is that Tzadik V'Ralom, why does the righteous suffer? Because it's Tzadik Ben Rasha, because his parent was a Rasha. Now, on one level, this is a troubling answer. And indeed, later on in the Gemara, there's an opinion that we don't know the answer, that Moshe wanted to hear the answer, but he was not told so. Be that as it may, Rav Alkavetz has a new reading of that Gemara. Tzadik ben Rasha does not mean he suffers because his parents were Rishayim. That would be a problem of injustice. Right? Maybe one doesn't deserve to suffer for one parent's sins. This is also a classic question. Says Rav Alkavetz, Tzadik ben Rasha means you in your previous life were a Rasha. Right? Not that you're the child of Rasha, but so to speak, this new guise, this new body is the offspring of a previous entry of the soul into a Rasha. So again, we see the theodicy argument being a strong argument on behalf of Gilgul Neshamot. We have that in the Sefer Bahir, in the Ramban's commentary on Yov, in Rabbeinu Bachaye, and in Rav Alkabetz's reading of the Gemara Brachot. A second argument in favor of Gilgul Neshamot has to do with the explanation of certain mitzvot. There was an argument that certain mitzvot make much more sense if one believes in Gilgul Neshamot. Now, there are several examples of this, but I'm going to mention or focus more on the classic one. For example, some people thought Tsar Balechayim might take on a new dimension if you think that the animal might be the reincarnation of a human being. I'm not going to emphasize that because, first of all, that's not as dominant as the one I will mention. Second of all, not all adherents in Gilgul believe that a soul could be reincarnated in an animal. So let's leave that aside. But the classic mitzvah that was used as a basis for Gilgul Neshamot was the mitzvah of Yibum, the Levirate marriage. A brother passes away, a married brother passed away without having children. So there's a mitzvah for his brother to marry the widow of the deceased called Yibum. It's not obligatory. There's a way out called Chalitza. But you could do it. And it says that this will somehow, Yakum al Shem Achiv. This will somehow establish the name of the deceased brother. And many mafarshim tried to figure out what exactly is the point of this mitzvah. Why, how will this enable the brother's name to live on? Now, one could argue that one does not need a grand mystical idea here. It's more psychological. If one knows that the brother married the widow to perpetuate the name of the deceased, then that will have an impact on how people think about the offspring. They will think about them as also perpetuating the family of the deceased. However, the Kabbalist said what's going on here is Gilgul Neshamot. And again, the Ramban in his commentary on the Torah, in Breishis Lamed Chet, commenting on the Yehuda and Tamar story, again says it's a Sod. Interestingly, the Ramban thought this was something that should not be publicized. Rabbeinu Bachai once again tells us it's about Gilgul. And apparently it works as follows. The Kabbalists believe that the soul of the deceased can be brought back, but family members who share a connection are better at bringing that soul back down. And therefore, if the brother of the deceased marries the widow, that will enable the soul to more easily come back to this earth. And therefore, the perpetuation of the name is not a psychological idea, it's a real idea. The soul of the deceased lives on in the offspring. And some Kabbalists even tried to figure out why this is only true for the brother. Right? There's a conversation why brothers can bring out the deceased soul more readily than, let's say, parents. So let's leave aside that question. But we see Gilgul Neshamot as manifest in an explanation for certain mitzvot. This actually leads to some interesting readings of Sukkim. Of course, in the Yehuda and Tamar story, right? Some of the sons of Yehuda don't want to perform Yibum. Right? After the first son dies, it says, Vayeda onan ki lo lo yiyah hazara. What does it mean, ki lo lo yiyah hazara? The offspring will not be his. So it doesn't only mean, according to the Ramban, that people will associate the offspring with the deceased brother, but rather that he will have a real sense it's not his. Meaning, it's not my son, it's my brother come back into a new body. And therefore, those sons of Yehuda did not want to engage in the act of Yibum. So here we have a second manifestation of where Yibum might come from. There is a third argument on behalf of Yibum. Sorry, not Yibum, of Gilgul. There's a third argument on behalf of Gilgul, which is Gilgul allows more time to finish projects. One might have a sense that one life is not enough, but I wanted to do something, I wanted to perfect a certain character trait, and I was not able to, and Gilgul Neshamot will enable me to do so. This is especially acute for several Kabbalists, including Reb Chaim Vital, who taught that to perfect the soul, you really need to do all 613 mitzvot. If one takes that position, so then it would often require coming back in various guises to enable the individual soul to fulfill all the mitzvot. And there are some difficulties here. Will we make each soul come back as a king, as a kohen, as a man and a woman? Leaving that aside, though, I think the idea of the unfinished project is something we can certainly understand. And this might be another argument, another motivation to be in favor of Gilgul Neshamot. There are some other arguments that I'll mention offhand, although I think they are less central. Sometimes people would argue that the reading of certain psukim motivate us to believe in Gilgul Neshamot. For example, the pasuk in Kohelet, Dor Holech V'Dor Ba. So the Kabbalists argue doesn't mean one generation comes and a totally distinct generation replaces them, but rather it's the generation that leaves that comes. Dor Holech Hu HaDor Sheba. Now that's a clever reading of the pasuk, but it's certainly not the reading that the pasuk demands. And I would argue the other motivations really led to Gilgul, and then afterwards there was a search for psukim, which might be suggestive of it. There are other phenomena that have led people to believe in reincarnation, such as deja vu and child prodigies and the like, but it seems to me that they are less pronounced in Jewish sources. So to sum up, the major arguments in favor of Gilgul would be as a solution to theodicy, and perhaps especially so in the case of the suffering child. Secondly, as an explanation for several mitzvot, in particular for the mitzvah of Yibum. Finally, as a way of fulfilling certain projects, in particular if one has a sense that the soul needs to go through several stages, such as finishing the Tariag mitzvot, to achieve completion. Okay, now notice again, most of the voices we cited in favor were Kabbalists, right? The Ramban, the Rabbeinu Bachai, and Rosh Shlomo Alkovetz, and Reb Chaim Vital. I should point out, once again, the Abarbanel is an adherent of Gilgul, and it's no accident that the Abarbanel's discussion of Gilgul is in Kitete, where the Torah has the mitzvah of Yibum. Right? Yibum is one of the classic sources for Gilgul. He quotes the Aristotelian objections, affirms his belief in Gilgul, and views it as a way of explaining the mitzvah of Yibum. Okay, let us now turn to the other side. What are the arguments against Gilgul? Before we get to the explicit arguments, I would like to point out that Rav Sadia Gaon in Emunot V'Deot, in Mamar Vav, rejects the concept of Gilgul. Unfortunately, he does not really give us his arguments against it. What he does do is cite several arguments given in favor of it and tries to negate them. Now, it's just noteworthy there, one of the arguments he cites in favor of it is again the suffering of children. So again, we see the central role that the Odyssey plays in the discussion of Gilgul. Rav Sadigan says there's perhaps other ways to explain the suffering of the righteous or the suffering of children, and therefore one should not accept this erroneous belief of Gilgul. The Rambam, as I said, never mentions it. I think there's good reason to believe the Rambam didn't believe in it, both because of the silence that he didn't mention it in any text, and his conception of the soul might render it impossible. Then other Rishonim, particularly in the medieval rationalist school, gave specific arguments against it. Rav Chasdai Kreskas in Mamar Dalet Perek Zayin of Or Hashem. So Rav Chasdai Kreskas in his classic philosophic work says, well, since the soul has accumulated a certain amount of intellectual knowledge, a certain amount of cognitive information, so how come when the soul comes back, all of a sudden it forgets its memory? And he suggests, well, the fact that the soul does not forget it, does not remember things from its previous life, would be an argument against Gilgul. He does say, in the Kabbalah hu nikabel. But if there's a received tradition, so I'm not going to argue the received tradition. I think one already sees the influence of the Mekubalim in this time period. Rav Chasdai Kreskas says this might be a received tradition, and then I would give in. But on a logical basis, I think it's not a correct doctrine. Now, the Kabbalists, of course, would have to come up with a mechanism for how the soul does not remember the information accumulated in previous lifetimes. Perhaps there's another way to say Rav Chasdai Kreskas' critique, which I will return to at the end of this shiur. That's one argument against it. Rav Yosef Albo had already mentioned the Sefer Karin, Mamar Dalet Perek Chavtet. So he says that, theoretically, Judaism could believe in Gilgul, because again, he adopts a Platonic notion of the soul as something separate from the body. However, he suggests that there would be no point. And he says, why does the soul enter a physical garment, a physical body? Well, that's because the soul can't really experience free choice as a disembodied soul. It's only the entry into the body that enables it to experience free choice. This is what Rav Yosef Albo says. And he says, once the soul has had that endeavor, has undergone that, there would be no point to doing it again. Right? This is his argument. Now again, the Kabbalists could argue that there's a longer life, there's a point. I mean, what do you mean there's no point? But Rav Yosef Albo seems to think the soul shouldn't have to spend extra time in the body. One life, that's neater, that should be sufficient to experience the challenge of free choice, and that will suffice. Therefore, Yosef Albo rejects Gilgul. Perhaps the most fascinating argument against Gilgul is cited by a Spanish Rishon named Rav Yedaya Bederchi. And he wrote a work called Igeret Hitnatzkut, which is a defense of philosophy. It's well known that during the Middle Ages, there was a huge controversy about the Rambam's philosophy and medieval rationalism. And there were several bans made against the study of philosophy. Although even those bans, it's quite fascinating, often say don't study it before you're 25, right? They're not a lifetime ban. So the Rashba was one of the anti-rationalists. He was someone who was involved in the ban on philosophy. Rav Yehudai Bederchi defends philosophy. Among his defense is the fascinating point that philosophy is helpful religiously because it saves you from fundamental religious errors. Now, it's not as surprising that he mentions the example of divine corporeality. Right, if you, the non-philosophers might take the hand of God literally, that God is a physical being, and it's a pure philosophic rationalism that explains that God cannot have the limitations of physicality. But he also says it saves us from the erroneous belief of Gilgul. Now, what's so bad about Gilgul? So fascinatingly, Rav Yedaya Bederchi says it will lead people to be mitrashel, to be lazy in their efforts. And this could be for one of two reasons. But they're both really working along the same lines. Once one believes that this life is not all there is, that one's in a continuum of various lives, one might, by definition, diminish the importance of what's going on now. For example, one might think, I was presumably a tzaddik in my previous lives, and therefore I've got it made. Or, I was so bad that that's why why am I suffering. Let's say someone experiences suffering. I might be suffering now because I was terrible in my previous lives. And there might be a sense of despair. Meaning, according to Rav Yedaya Bederchi, it's more a psychological argument. Gilgul's problematic because it moves the focus away from the here and now. And religious life should be what I am now, what are my good parts, what are my bad parts, what have I done well, what have I sinned in, what do I need to work on, without shifting my focus elsewhere. So it's almost like from a psychological or from what will be more beneficial for a religious person to believe in, he argues it's more beneficial to not believe in Gilgul Nefeshot. That's Rav Yedaya Bederchi's argument. just to point out, it's quite fascinating, the Mishnah Berurah in the Shaar HaTzion, when he discusses why we read Maftir Yonah on Yom Kippur, takes the exact opposite approach. He says, someone might think that, okay, they failed and that's it. No, realize that you'll have to come back again and again until you succeed. And Maftir Yonah is a reminder of that, that you cannot escape what God's will is. Even if running away will just cause more difficulties in along the path. And therefore, he actually thinks Gilgal would be an argument to do the right thing now. They do it now, so you don't have to come back again. So you almost have this fascinating psychological question, will belief in Gilgal lead to greater religious performance or lesser religious performance? Rabbi Dershi also mentions the problem of Tchiyat HaMetim, which is if one has several identities, several bodies, which one will be resurrected? Now, I'm going to argue at the end there might be a deeper meaning here, because presumably the Kabbalists could give an answer. Some Kabbalists will say, the first body is your real body. That's the one that will be resurrected. Some might say the last body is your real body. That's the one that will be resurrected. Others might say there will be some spark of all of them coming together in the world to come in the resurrection. I'm going to argue that Rabbi Dershi's argument might cut a little bit more sharply if you say it in a slightly different fashion. Before we get there, I'd like to mention two more arguments, and then we'll get to the point I'm heading towards at the end. There's a very interesting work by Leon de Modena, Rabbi Aryeh Leib Modena, who was a preacher in Italy, and he was a pretty strong critic of Kabbalah. He actually has a whole work called Ari Noheim, which is a critique of the Kabbalah. He also has a shorter piece called Ben David, which is a critique of Gilgul Nefashot. And in Ben David, he mentions the argument that this is not mentioned anywhere in Tanakh. He says, surely if Gilgul Nefashot would be a Jewish belief, we find a mention of it. There'd be a pasuk, there'd be a chazal, an agadah, a midrash. One cannot point to any work of chazal, any statement of chazal, that's a clear support for Gilgul Neshamah. So this is the Ben David argument. Now, as I mentioned, in theory the Kabbalists would have an easy response. They would say, but we've already said that this is an esoteric doctrine. And since it's an esoteric doctrine, it's not surprising that you don't have it. Although here, I think something very interesting emerges. I think one can ask, why does this need to be an esoteric doctrine? Let us say that Gilgul Neshamot is true. What would be wrong with people knowing about it? So the famous academic scholar of Kabbalah, Gershom Shalom, points this out. And he actually leaves it as a question he can't really understand. He has in his discussion of Gilgul Neshamot, he says he's trying to figure out what would be so dangerous, he says, Ma alot liot hasakanot hakuchot behora'at Torah zu. If we teach this Torah, what danger would it lead to? I mean, what's the problem with the idea of Gilgul Neshamot? So perhaps Ben David would say to the Kabbalists, well, why should this be esoteric? And then say, well, if the Gemara does not mention it, it's probably not part of Judaism. I just thought when I was preparing the Shiur, for the first time, maybe Rav Yedaya Bar Dershi could help the Kabbalists, quite ironically. His argument about the psychological dangers of Gilgul, he views as an argument against the very concept of Gilgul. It should lead us to say that Gilgul Nefeshot does not exist. But maybe the fact that there could be a religiously problematic outgrowth of belief in Gilgul, that it would shift the urgency away from this life. So if that's true, so maybe it is dangerous. So quite fascinatingly, we could take the argument from a critic of Gilgul and use it to explain why it might be esoteric. In addition, I would point out, even if we don't understand why it's esoteric, there clearly were figures in Jewish history who thought that it should be an esoteric doctrine. And here the Ramban is a great illustration. Again, without knowing why, the Ramban, both when he's explaining Iyov, when he's explaining theodicy, and when he's explaining Yibum, refuses to explicitly identify the word Gilgul. He'll say, Sodot HaTorah, or Sod HaIbur, with the assumption that only the initiates will get what the Ramban is talking about. So here, then we have a concrete historical example of someone who thought that this is something that should not be revealed to everybody. So even if we do not understand why it should be esoteric, the fact that some figures, some great figures in our history, felt it should be esoteric, might be a basis for arguing that the absence of this position in Chazal would not prove anything. I would like to bring things towards a conclusion with one final argument. And this is an argument that's not explicit in Jewish sources, but I think some of the arguments we saw might connect very directly to this argument. There's a famous question in the history of philosophy, what defines a personal identity? meaning what makes me me, and what would make me me in some other guise. And here there's a lot of different things one could point to. For example, one could say, my body, that's who I am. This is Yitzchak Blau, this body. And then, of course, that body's not there, so it's not Yitzchak Blau anymore. Alternatively, one say, it's the memories of being a certain person. If I remember what I did since my childhood, that's who I am. There are certain philosophic difficulties with each position, which I'm not getting into right now. A third possibility might focus on certain personality traits. Who is Yitzchak Blau? The person who's like this, this amount of compassion, this amount of courage, this amount of some other traits, that is who the person is. There is a fourth possibility that I'm going to negate, which is that there's some spiritual essence beyond the other three that's who the real person. But I think we can realize that that spiritual essence has nothing to do with your personality or your memories, so it'd be difficult to view that as the real you. Right? If you have someone who's not in the same body and doesn't have the same memories and has a totally different personality, and then you tell me it's the same spiritual essence, I think it's a bit difficult. So this is something that philosophers debated back and forth, and John Locke wrote about it, and several others wrote about it. David Hume even denied the whole concept of personal identity. It's just one sensation after another, as it were. And contemporary philosophers have debated at great length as well. Now, I'm not, in this context, going to give all the arguments back and forth. I will just point out that it could be the more commonality you have between identities, the easier it is to argue that it's the same person. So if we talk about three factors, we talk about the physical body and the memory, same memories, and personality, and then say, to the degree that we have one of those factors, or two of those factors, or three of those factors, it's easier to talk about the same identity. Now let us turn to Gilgul Neshamot. One question that might be raised against Gilgul is what makes the child the same person who passed away 50 years ago? Now, the child clearly does not have the same body, nor does the child have the same memory. One would then have to talk about the same personality. Now, again, if one thinks that personality alone will be a difficult position without memory in the body, which is, I don't want to get into the details now, it becomes more difficult to talk about Gilgul Neshamot. This might be a new angle for understanding both Rav Chasdai Kreskas and Rav Yedaya Bedershi. If we remember, Rav Chasdai Kreskas said, why does the soul not remember the knowledge it accumulated in its previous existence? Now, I pointed out that the Kabbalists might say they have mechanisms for how the soul forgets it. But maybe the point is, okay, but if it forgets it, is it the same person? Like, what does it mean to be the same person but to not remember anything of your life? Even personality is very tied up with memory, right? Can you have a personality without remembering anything that happened in your previous life? So maybe a new way to take Rav Chasdai Kreskas' critique is that it shakes up the identification of the new child with the previous body with a deceased fellow. The same thing can be said about Rav Yedaya Bedershi's second critique. What's the problem with Tchiyat HaMetim? Not only which body will be resurrected, as if it's like a problem of choice, but the question of which body will be resurrected points to the difficulty in affirming this is all the same identity. If the person was a medieval knight in the 1200s, and a farmer in the 1600s, and a lawyer in the 20th century, with totally different personalities, so could one really say that it's all the same person? Now that question is really manifest, is very much shown in the problem of Tchiyat HaMetim, of who will come back. Okay, I'm not going to get into how the Kabbalists might answer the personal identity question, but I'd like to sum up the class and perhaps leave us some food for thought for next time. We've seen that if one starts with the Aristotelian conception of the soul, and it's really not distinct from the body, it's very difficult to believe in Gilgul, and indeed the Rambam's silence probably means the Rambam did not believe in it. We've seen that, in general, there's a split between the medieval rationalists and the Kabbalists, with the medieval rationalists such as Rav Sadigon and Rav Yosef Albo and Rav Yedaya Bedershi being against it, and the Kabbalists being in favor. I did point out that the Abarbanel, who perhaps is not exactly in either camp, was also a believer in Gilgul. We also saw the essential arguments for, again, being as a solution to the problem of theodicy, and perhaps the solution to the most difficult problem of theodicy, the suffering of a child, and as a explanation for various mitzvot, in particular the mitzvah of Yibum. Again, the Abarbanel explains Gilgul in the context of Yibum and justifies it. I mentioned Rav Alkabetz wrote a parish on Rut called Shoresh Yishai. So I talked about it in the context of theodicy, but of course, Rut has an example, arguably, of Yibum, when someone has to marry Rut, whose husband is deceased, and Boaz does some kind of quasi-form of Yibum. There again, Rav Alkabetz talks about Gilgumashimot. Finally, as a way of finishing projects, as in the worldview of Rav Chaim Vital. On the other hand, we have arguments against. Sadi Yon just rejects it offhand. If you hold that the Rambam, like the Rambam in the Aristotelian conception of the soul, you will also end up rejecting Gilgul. We have Rav Chafei Kreska saying, well, why doesn't the soul remember what happened in the previous life? Rav Yosef Albo suggesting that it's pointless. There's only a point to the soul coming into the body once and experiencing the challenge of free choice over one lifetime. So there should be no point to having to do it again over a second lifetime. We saw with Yedai Bedershi's argument that it will lead to hitrash shlut, right? One might despair or one might be overconfident in a previous life. Conversely, one could say, I didn't mention this, but one could also argue, one might say, all right, I'll get it right in the next life. This life I'll enjoy. The next life I'll worry about the religious issues and religious responsibilities. So therefore, he thought that it was a problematic belief because it led people to not take this life with a great sense of urgency. Of course, we saw that the Chafetz Chaim and the Shaar Tzion in Tuf Kaf Chaf Bet with Mati Yona argues the exact opposite. Then we had the argument of Tchir Meitim, the problem of which body will come back in the resurrection. Finally, we had Leon de Modena in his Ben David arguing that the absence of this doctrine in Chazal militates against acceptance of Gilgul as a Jewish doctrine. Just to sum up the last 2 points, we raise the following. What would be esoteric about Gilgul? Because the answer to Leon de Modena's point must be that Gilgul was too esoteric to say explicitly in a Pasuk or in a Mamar Chazal, and Gershom Sholem cannot figure out why is this a big secret. I pointed out 2 things. First of all, that Rabbi Yehuda Bedershi might give a good argument for, ironically, for the Kabbalists, that this could be religiously dangerous and misleading. Secondly, the fact that the Ramban, for whatever reason, clearly did treat it as esoteric doctrine. So there clearly is a pattern of those who thought this was not for everybody. That was the second to last thing. Finally, I raised a new issue, the philosophic question of personal identity. That maybe the problem with Gilgul is that it's hard, or it's not clear what makes the new child the same person as the old child. And we mentioned briefly some of the philosophical questions regarding personal identity. And I pointed out that some of the classic criteria of personal identity, such as memory and body, bodily continuity would not apply to Gilgul. Perhaps that's what Rav Chafei Kreskas meant about his point about memory. Perhaps that is what Rav Yehuda Bedershi meant in his point about Tchiyat HaMitim. Clearly, the identity question could also come up when we discuss where the world will come in resurrection. So just to set the stage for next time, and I'll stop, we already have to discuss the Platonic soul and Aristotelian soul in terms of Olam Haba and Tchiyat HaMitim, and we have to discuss continuity of identity. Right? Even those who don't believe in Gilgul Neshamot, who do believe in Tchiyat HaMitim or Olam Haba, right, which is obvious, those are universal Jewish beliefs, as we'll discuss, they will have to work out what makes the person the same. I would just like to point out, though, I think I've shown that the question of Gilgul is not just like a curiosity, like Judaism in science fiction or Judaism in the occult, but touches on crucial issues. How should we understand mitzvot? How should we deal with the problem of theodicy? What attitude will lead to a better religious life or to a poor religious life? What will create a sense of urgency? These are really essential religious issues. They're not just a curiosity. And I hope as we go along that we'll all enjoy the other discussions we'll get to, such as Tchiyat HaMitim and Olam Haba, and finally, to what degree we should be thinking about these things as a motivational tool altogether. It's been a pleasure learning with you, and I look forward very much to next week.